the counter, on which it said, 2 plants for 50 kroner. Given that Uwe only wanted 1 plant, he explained to the shop assistant, with all rhyme and reason on his side, he should be able to buy it for 25 kroner, because that was half of 50. However, the assistant, a brain-dead, phone-texting 19-year-old, would not go along with it. She maintained that a single flower cost 39 kroner and 2 for 50 only applied if one bought 2. The manager had to be summoned. It took Uwe 15 minutes to make him see sense and agree that Uwe was right. Or to be honest about it, the manager mumbled something that sounded a little like bloody old sod into his hand and hammered 25 kroner so hard into the cash register that anyone would have thought it was the machine's fault. It made no difference to Uwe. He knew these retailers were always trying to screw you out of money, and no one screwed Uwe and got away with it. Uwe put his debit card on the counter. The manager allowed himself the slightest of smiles, then nodded dismissively and pointed at a sign that read, "Card purchases of less than 50 kroner carry a surcharge of 3 kroner. Now Uwe is standing in front of his wife with 2 plants. Because it was a question of principle. "There was no way I was going to pay 3 kroner, rails Uwe, his eyes looking down into the gravel. Uwe's wife often quarrels with Uwe because he's always arguing about everything. But Uwe isn't bloody arguing, he just thinks right is right. Is that such an unreasonable attitude to life? He raises his eyes and looks at her.
"I suppose you're annoyed I didn't come yesterday like I promised," he mumbles.
She doesn't say anything.
"The whole street is turning into a madhouse," he says defensively. "Complete chaos. You even have to go out and back up their trailers for them nowadays. You can't even put up a hook in peace," he continues as if she's disagreeing.
He clears his throat.
"Obviously, I couldn't put the hook up when it was dark outside. If you do that, there's no telling when the lights go off. More likely, they'll stay on and consume electricity. Out of the question."
She doesn't answer. He kicks the frozen ground, sort of looking for words. Clears his throat briefly once again.
"Nothing works when you're not at home."
She doesn't answer. Uwe fingers the plants.
"I'm tired of it, just rattling around the house all day while you're away."
She doesn't answer that either. He nods, holds up the plants so she can see them.
"They're pink, the ones you like. They said in the shop they're perennials, but that's not what they're bloody called. Apparently they die in this kind of cold. They also said that in the shop, but only so they could sell me a load of other shit."
He looks as if he's waiting for her approval.
"The new neighbors put saffron in their rice and things like that. They're foreigners," he says in a low voice.
A new silence. He stands there, slowly twisting the wedding ring on his finger, as if looking for something else to say. He still finds it painfully difficult being the one to take charge of a conversation. That was always something she took care of. He usually just answered. This is a new situation for them both. Finally, Uwe squats, digs up the plant he brought last week, and carefully puts it in a plastic bag. He turns the frozen soil carefully before putting in the new plants.
"They bumped up the electricity prices again,"
he informs her as he gets to his feet. He looks at her for a long time. Finally, he puts his hand carefully on the big boulder and caresses it tenderly from side to side, as if touching her cheek.
"I miss you," he whispers.
It's been 6 months since she died, but Uwe still inspects the whole house twice a day to feel the radiators and check that she hasn't sneakily turned up the heating. Chapter 5. A Man Called Uwe. Uwe knew very well that her friends couldn't understand why she married him. He couldn't really blame them. People said he was bitter. Maybe they were right.
he'd never reflected much on it. People also called him antisocial. Uwe assumed this meant he wasn't overly keen on people, and in this instance, he could totally agree with them. More often than not, people were out of their minds. Uwe wasn't one to engage in small talk. He had come to realize that, these days at least, this was a serious character flaw. Now, one had to be able to blabber on about anything with any old sod who happened to stray within an arm's length of you purely because it was nice. Uwe didn't know how to do it. Perhaps it was the way he'd been raised. Maybe men of his generation had never been sufficiently prepared for a world where everyone spoke about doing things even though it no longer seemed worth doing them. Nowadays, people stood outside their newly refurbished houses and boasted as if they'd built them with their own bare hands, even though they hadn't so much as lifted a screwdriver. And they weren't even trying to pretend that it was any other way. They boasted about it. Apparently, there was no longer any value in being able to lay your own floorboards or refurbish a room with rising damp or change the winter tires. And if you could just go and buy everything, what was the value of it? What was the value of a man? Her friends couldn't see why she woke up every morning and voluntarily decided to share the whole day with him. He couldn't either. He built her a bookshelf, and she filled it with books by people who wrote page after page about their feelings. Uwe understood things he could see and touch, wood and concrete, glass and steel, tools, things one could figure out. He understood right angles and clear instruction manuals, assembly models and drawings, things one could draw on paper. He was a man of black and white, and she was color, all the color he had. The only thing he had ever loved until he saw her was numbers. He had no other particular memory of his youth. He was not bullied, and he wasn't a bully. Not good at sports, and not bad either. He was never at the heart of things and never on the outside. He was the sort of person who was just there. Nor did he remember so very much about his growing up. He had never been the sort of man who went around remembering things unless there was a need for it. He remembered that he was quite happy and that for a few years afterwards, he wasn't. That was about it. And he remembered the sums, the numbers, filling his head, remembered how he longed for their mathematics lessons at school. Maybe for the others they were a sufferance, but not for him. He didn't know why and didn't speculate about it either. He'd never understood the need to go around stewing on why things turned out the way they did. You are what you are and you do what you do, and that was good enough for Uwe. He was 7 years old when his mom called it a day one early August morning. She worked at a chemicals plant. In those days, people didn't know much about air safety, Uwe realized later. She smoked as well, all the time. That's Uwe's clearest memory of her, how she sat in the kitchen window of the little house where they lived outside town, with that billowing cloud around her, watching the sky every Saturday morning, and how sometimes she sang in her hoarse voice, and Uwe used to sit under the window with his mathematics book in his lap. And he remembered that he liked listening to her. He remembers that. Of course, her voice was hoarse and the odd note was more discordant than one would have liked, but he remembers that he liked it anyway. Uwe's father worked for the railways. The palms of his hands looked like someone had carved into leather with knives, and the wrinkles in his face were so deep that when he exerted himself, the sweat was channeled through them down to his chest. His hair was thin and his body slender, but the muscles on his arms were so sharp that they seemed cut out of rock. Once when Uwe was very young, he was allowed to go with his parents to a big party with his dad's friends from the rail company. After his father had put away a couple of bottles of Pilsner, some of the other guests challenged him to an arm wrestling competition. Uwe had never seen the like of these giants, straddling the bench opposite him. Some of them looked like they weighed about 400 pounds. His father wore down every one of them. When they went home that night, he put his arm around Uwe's shoulders and said, "Uwe, only a swine thinks size and strength are the same thing. Remember that." And Uwe never forgot it. His father never raised his fists, not to Uwe or anyone else. Uwe had classmates who came to school with black eyes or bruises from a belt buckle after a thrashing, but never Uwe. "We don't fight in this family," his father used to state, "not with each other or anyone else." He was well-liked down at the railway, quiet, but kind. There were some who said he was too kind. Uwe remembers how, as a child, he could never understand how this could be something bad. Then Mum died, and Dad grew even quieter, as if she took away with her the few words he'd possessed. So Uwe and his father never talked excessively, but they liked each other's company. They sat in silence on either side of the kitchen table and had ways of keeping busy. Every other day they put out food for a family of birds living in a rotting tree at the back of the house. It was important, Uwe understood, that it had to be every other day. He didn't know why, but that didn't matter. In the evenings they had sausages and potatoes. Then they played cards. They never had much, but they always had enough. His father's only remaining words were about engines. Apparently his mother was content to leave these behind. He could spend any amount of time talking about them. "Engines give you what you deserve," he used to explain. "If you treat them with respect, they'll give you freedom. If you behave like an ass, they'll take it from you." For a long time, he did not own a car of his own. But in the 1940s and 50s, when the bosses and directors at the railway started buying their own vehicles, a rumor soon spread in the office that the quiet man working on the track was a person well worth knowing. Uwe's father had never finished school and didn't understand much about the sums in Uwe's school books, but he understood engines. When the daughter of the director was getting married and the wedding car broke down rather than ceremoniously transporting the bride to the church, Uwe's father was sent for. He came cycling with a toolbox on his shoulder so heavy that it took two men to lift it when he got off the bicycle. Whatever the problem was when he arrived, it was no longer a problem when he cycled back. The director's wife invited him to the wedding reception, but he told her that it was probably not the done thing to sit with elegant people when one was the sort of man whose forearms were so stained with oil that it seemed a natural part of his pigmentation. But he'd gladly accept a bag of bread and meat for the lad at home, he said. Uwe had just turned 8. When his father laid out the supper that evening, Uwe felt like he was at a royal banquet. A few months later, the director sent for Uwe's father again. In the parking area outside the office stood an extremely old and worse for wear Saab 92. It was the first motor car Saab had ever manufactured, although it had not been in production since the significantly upgraded Saab 93 had come onto the market. Uwe's dad recognized it very well. Front-wheel driven and a side-mounted engine that sounded like a coffee percolator. It had been in an accident, the director explained, sticking his thumbs into his suspenders under his jacket. The bottle-green body was badly dented, and the condition of what lay under the hood was certainly not pretty. But Uwe's father produced a little screwdriver from the pocket of his dirty overalls, and after lengthily inspecting the car, he gave the verdict that with a bit of time and care and the proper tools, he'd be able to put it back into working order. "Whose is it?" he wondered aloud as he straightened up and wiped the oil from his fingers with a rag. "It belonged to a relative of mine," said the director, digging out a key from his suit trousers and pressing it into his palm. "And now it's yours." With a pat on his shoulder, the director returned to the office. Uwe's father stayed where he was in the courtyard, trying to catch his breath. That evening, he had to explain everything over and over again to his goggle-eyed son and show all there was to know about this magical monster now parked in their garden. He sat in the driver's seat half the night with the boy on his lap, explaining how all the mechanical parts were connected. he could account for every screw, every little tube. Uwe had never seen a man as proud as his father was that night. He was 8 years old and decided that night he would never drive any car but a Saab. Whenever he had a Saturday off, Uwe's father brought him out into the yard, opened the hood, and taught him all the names of the various parts and what they did. On Sundays, they went to church. Not because either of them had any excessive zeal for God, but because Uwe's mom had always been insistent about it. They sat at the back, each of them staring at a patch on the floor until it was over. And, in all honesty, they spent more time missing Uwe's mom than thinking about God. It was her time, so to speak, even though she was no longer there. Afterwards, they'd take a long drive in the countryside with the Saab. It was Uwe's favorite part of the week. That year, to stop him rattling around the house on his own, he also started going with his father to work at the railway yard after school. It was filthy work and badly paid, but as his father used to mutter, "It's an honest job, and that's worth something." Uwe liked all the men at the railway yard except Tom. Tom was a tall, noisy man with fists as big as flatbed carts and eyes that always seemed to be looking for some defenseless animal to kick around. When Uwe was 9 years old, his dad sent him to help Tom clean out a broken-down railway car. With sudden jubilation, Tom snatched up a briefcase left by some harassed passenger. It had fallen from the luggage rack and distributed its contents over the floor. Before long, Tom was darting about on all fours, scrabbling together everything he could see. "Finders keepers," he spat at Uwe. Something in his eyes made Uwe feel as if there were insects crawling under his skin. As Uwe turned to go, he stumbled over a wallet. It was made of such soft leather that it felt like cotton against his rough fingertips. And it didn't have a rubber band around it, like Dad's old wallet, to keep it from falling to bits. It had a little silver button that made a click when you opened it. There was more than 6,000 kroner inside, a fortune to anyone in those days. Tom caught sight of it and tried to tear it out of Uwe's hands. Overwhelmed by an instinctive defiance, the boy resisted. He saw how shocked Tom was at this, and out of the corner of his eye, he had time to see the huge man clenching his fist. Uwe knew he'd never be able to get away, so he closed his eyes, held on to the wallet as hard as he could, and waited for the blow. But the next thing either of them knew, Uwe's father was standing between them. Tom's furious, hateful eyes met his for an instant, but Uwe's father stood where he stood. And at last, Tom lowered his fist and took a watchful step back.
"Finders keepers, it's always been like that," he growled, pointing at the wallet.
"That's up to the person who finds it," said Uwe's father, without looking away. Tom's eyes had turned black, but he retreated another step, still clutching the briefcase in his hands. Tom had worked many years at the railway, but Uwe had never heard any of his father's colleagues say one good word about Tom. He was dishonest and malicious. That was what they said after a couple of bottles of Pilsner at their parties, but he'd never heard it from his dad. "Four children and a sick wife," was all he used to say to his workmates, looking each of them in the eye. "Better men than Tom could have ended up worse for it." And then his workmates usually changed the subject. His father pointed to the wallet in Uwe's hand. "You decide," he said. Uwe determinedly fixed his gaze on the ground, feeling Tom's eyes burning holes into the top of his head. Then he said in a low but unwavering voice that the lost property office would seem to be the best place to leave it. His father nodded without a word and then took Uwe's hand as they walked back for almost half an hour, along the track without a word passing between them. Uwe heard Tom shouting behind them, his voice filled with cold fury. Uwe never forgot it. The woman at the desk of the lost property office could hardly believe her eyes when they put the wallet on the counter.
"And it was just lying there on the floor? You didn't find a bag or anything?" she asked.
Uwe gave his dad a searching look, but he just stood there in silence.
So Uva did the same. The woman behind the counter seemed satisfied enough with the answer. Not many people have ever handed in this much money, she said, smiling at Uva.
Many people don't have any decency either, said his father in a clipped voice, and took Uva's hand.
They turned around and went back to work. A few hundred yards down the track, Uva cleared his throat, summoned some courage, and asked why his father had not mentioned the briefcase that Tom had found.
We're not the sort of people who tell tales about what others do, he answered.
Uva nodded. They walked in silence.
I thought about keeping the money,
Uva whispered at long last, and took his father's hand in a firmer grip, as if he was afraid of letting go.
I know, said his father, and squeezed his hand a little harder. But I knew you would hand it in, and I knew a person like Tom wouldn't, said Uva.
His father nodded, and not another word was said about it. Had Uva been the sort of man who contemplated how and when one became the sort of man one was, he might have said this was the day he learned that right has to be right. But he wasn't one to dwell on things like that. He contented himself with remembering that on this day, he decided to be as little unlike his father as possible. He had only just turned 16 when his father died. A hurtling carriage on the track, Uva was left with not much more than a sob, a ramshackle house a few miles out of town, and a dented old wristwatch. He was never able to properly explain what happened to him that day, but he stopped being happy. He wasn't happy for several years after that. At the funeral, the vicar wanted to talk to him about foster homes, but he found out soon enough that Uva had not been brought up to accept charity. At the same time, Uva made it clear to the vicar that there was no need to reserve a place for him in the pews at Sunday service for the foreseeable future. Not because Uva did not believe in God, he explained to the vicar, but because, in his view, this God seemed to be a bit of a bloody swine. The next day, he went down to the wages office at the railway and handed back the wages for the rest of the month. The ladies at the office didn't understand, so Uva had to impatiently explain that his father had died on the 16th, and obviously wouldn't be able to come in and work for the remaining 14 days of that month. And because he got his wages in advance, Uva had come to pay back the balance. Hesitantly, the ladies asked him to sit down and wait. After 15 minutes or so, the director came out and looked at the peculiar 16-year-old sitting on a wooden chair in the corridor with his dead father's pay packet in his hand. The director knew very well who this boy was. And after he'd convinced himself that there was no way of persuading him to keep the money, he felt he had no right to. The director saw no alternative but to propose to Uva that he should work for the rest of the month and earn his right to it. Uva thought this seemed a reasonable offer and notified his school that he'd be absent for the next 2 weeks. He never went back. He worked for the railways for 5 years. Then one morning he boarded a train and saw her for the first time. That was the first time he'd laughed since his father's death. And life was never again the same. People said Uva saw the world in black and white, but she was color. All the color he had.
Chapter 6 A man called Uva and a bicycle that should have been left where bicycles are left.
Uva just wants to die in peace. Is that really too much to ask? Uva doesn't think so.
Fair enough. He should have arranged it 6 months ago, straight after her funeral. But you couldn't bloody carry on like that, he decided at the time. He had his job to take care of. How would it look if people stopped coming to work all over the place because they'd killed themselves?
Uva's wife died on a Friday, was buried on Sunday, and then Uva went to work on Monday, because that's how one handles things. And then 6 months went by, and out of the blue, the managers came in on Monday and said they hadn't wanted to deal with it on Friday because they didn't want to ruin his weekend. And on Tuesday, he stood there oiling his kitchen worktops. So, he's prepared everything. He's paid the undertakers and arranged his place in the churchyard next to her. He's called the lawyers and written a letter with clear instructions, and put it in an envelope with all his important receipts and the deeds of the house and the service history of the Saab. He's put this envelope in the inside pocket of his jacket. He's paid all the bills. He has no loans and no debts, so no one will have to clear up anything after him. He's even washed up his coffee cup and canceled the newspaper subscription. He is ready. And all he wants is to die in peace, he thinks, as he sits in the Saab and looks out of the open garage door. If he can just avoid his neighbors, he may even be able to get away by this afternoon. He sees the heavily overweight young man from next door slouching past the garage door in the parking area. Not that Uwe dislikes fat people, certainly not. People can look any way they like. He has just never been able to understand them, can't fathom how they do it. How much can one person eat? How does one manage to turn oneself into a twin-size person? It must take a certain determination, he reflects. The young man notices him and waves cheerfully. Uwe gives him a curt nod. The young man stands there waving, setting his fat breasts into motion under his T-shirt. Uwe often says that this is the only man he knows who could attack a bowl of chips from all directions at once. But whenever he makes this comment, Uwe's wife protests and tells him one shouldn't say things like that. Or rather, she used to. Used to. Uwe's wife liked the overweight young man. After his mother passed away, she would go over once a week with a lunchbox. "So we get something home-cooked now and then," she used to say. Uwe noticed that they never got the containers back, adding that maybe the young man hadn't noticed the difference between the box and the food inside it. At which point, Uwe's wife would tell him that was enough. And then it was enough. Uwe waits until the lunchbox eater has gone before he gets out of the Saab. He tugs at the handle three times, closes the garage door behind him, tugs at the door handle three times, walks up the little footpath between the houses. Stops outside the bicycle shed. There's a woman's bicycle leaning up against the wall. Again. Right under the sign, clearly explaining that cycles should not be left in this precise spot. Uwe picks it up. The front tire is punctured. He unlocks the shed and places the bicycle tidily at the end of the row. He locks the door and has just tugged at it three times when he hears a late, pubescent voice jabbering in his ear.
"Whoa, what the hell are you doing?"
Uwe turns around and finds himself eye to eye with a whelp standing a few yards away.
"Putting a bike away in the bike shed."
"You can't do that."
On closer inspection, he may be 18 or so, Uwe suspects. More of a stripling than a whelp, in other words, if one wants to be pedantic about it.
"Yes, I can."
"But I'm repairing it,"
the youth bursts out, his voice rising into falsetto.
"But it's a lady's bike," protests Uwe.
"Yeah, so what?"
"It can hardly be yours, then,"
Uwe states condescendingly. The youth groans, rolling his eyes. Uwe puts his hands into his pockets, as if this is the end of the matter. There's a guarded silence. The lad looks at Uwe as if he finds Uwe unnecessarily thick. In return, Uwe looks at the creature before him as if it were nothing but a waste of oxygen. Behind the youth, Uwe notices there's another youth, even slimmer than the first one, and with black stuff all around his eyes. The second youth tugs carefully at the first's jacket and murmurs something about not causing trouble. His comrade kicks rebelliously at the snow as if it were the snow's fault.
"It's my girlfriend's bike," he mumbles at last.
He says it more with resignation than indignation. His sneakers are too big and his jeans too small, Uwe notes. His tracksuit jacket is pulled over his chin to protect him against the cold. His emaciated, peach-fuzzed face is covered in blackheads, and his hair looks as if someone saved him from drowning in a barrel by pulling him up by his locks.
"Where does she live, then?"
With profound exertion, as if he's been shot with a tranquilizer dart, the creature points with his whole arm towards the house at the far end of Uwe's street.
"Where those communists who pushed through the garbage sorting reform live with their daughters."
Uwe nods cautiously.
"She can pick it up in the bike shed, then," says Uwe.
tapping melodramatically at the sign prohibiting bicycles from being left in the area before turning around and heading back towards his house.
Grumpy old bastard!
The youth yells behind him.
Shh!
Utters his soot-eyed companion. Uva doesn't answer. He walks past the sign clearly prohibiting motor vehicles from entering the residential area, the one which the pregnant foreign woman apparently could not read, even though Uva knows very well that it's quite impossible not to see it. He should know, because he's the one who put it there. Dissatisfied, he walks down the little footpath between the houses, stamping his feet so that anyone who saw him would think he was trying to flatten the tarmac. As if it wasn't bad enough with all the nutters already living on the street, he thinks. As if the whole area was not already being converted into some bloody speed bump in evolutionary progress. The Audi poser and the blonde weed almost opposite Uva's house, and at the far end of the row, that communist family with their teenage daughters and their red hair and their shorts over their trousers. Their faces like mirror image raccoons. Well, most likely they're on holiday in Thailand at this precise moment, but anyway. In the house next to Uva lives the 25-year-old who's almost a quarter tonner. With his long feminine hair and strange t-shirts, he lived with his mother until she died of some illness a year or so ago. Apparently his name is Jimmy, Uva's wife has told him. Uva doesn't know what work Jimmy does, most likely something criminal. Unless he tests bacon for a living. In the house on the other side of Jimmy lived Rune and his wife. Uva wouldn't exactly call Rune his enemy. Or rather, he would. Everything that went to pot in the Residents Association began with Rune. He and his wife, Anita, moved into the area on the same day that Uva and Sonia moved in. At that time, Rune drove a Volvo. But later he bought a BMW. You just couldn't reason with a person who behaved like that. It was Rune who pushed through the coup d'etat that saw Uva deposed as chairman of the association, and just look at the state of the place now. Higher electricity bills, and bicycles that aren't put away in the bike shed, and people backing up with trailers in the residential area, in spite of signs clearly stating that it's prohibited. Uva has long warned about these awful things, but no one has listened. Since then, he has never showed his face in any meeting of the Residents Association. His mouth makes a movement as if it's just about to spit every time he mentally enunciates the words Residents Association, as if they were a gross indecency. He's 15 yards from his broken mailbox when he sees blonde weed. At first he can't comprehend what she's doing at all. She's swaying about on her heels on the footpath, gesturing hysterically at the facade of Uva's house. That little barking thing, more of a mutt than a proper dog, which has been pissing on Uva's paving stones, is running around her feet. Weed yells something so violently that her sunglasses slip down over the tip of her nose. Mutt barks even louder. So the old girl has finally lost her faculties, Uva thinks, standing warily a few yards behind her. Only then does he realize that she's actually not gesticulating at the house. She's throwing stones. And it isn't the house she's throwing them at. It's the cat. It sits squeezed into the far corner behind Uva's shed. It has little flecks of blood in its coat, or what's left of its coat. Mutt bares its teeth. The cat hisses back. "Don't you hiss it, Prince," wails Weed, picking up another stone from Uva's flower bed and hurling it at the cat. The cat jumps out of the way. The stone hits the windowsill. She picks up another stone and prepares to throw it. Uva takes two quick steps forward and stands so close behind her that she can most likely feel his breath. "If you throw that stone into my property, I'll throw you into your garden." She spins around. Their eyes meet. Uva has both hands in his pockets. She waves her fists in front of him as if trying to swat two flies the size of microwave ovens. Uva doesn't concede as much as a facial movement.
"That disgusting thing scratched Prince," she manages to say, her eyes wild with fury.
Uva peers down at Mutt. It growls at him. Then he looks at the cat, sitting humiliated and bleeding, but with its head defiantly raised, outside his house.
It's bleeding, so it seems to have ended in a draw, says Uva.
Like hell, I'll kill that piece of shit.
No, you won't, says Uva coldly. His insane neighbor begins to look threatening.
It's probably full of disgusting diseases and rabies and all sorts of things.
Uva looks at the cat, looks at the weed, nods. And so are you, most likely, but we don't throw stones at you because of it. Her lower lip starts trembling. She slides her sunglasses up over her eyes.
You watch yourself, she hisses.
Uva nods, points at Mutt. Mutt tries to bite his leg, but Uva stamps his foot down so hard that it backs off.
That thing should be kept on a leash inside the residential area, says Uva steadily.
She tosses her dyed hair and snorts so hard that Uva half expects a bit of snot to come flying out.
And what about that thing? She rages at the cat.
Never you bloody mind, Uva answers.
She looks at him in that particular way of people who feel both utterly superior and deeply insulted. Mutt bares its teeth in a silent growl.
You think you own this street or what, you bloody lunatic? She says.
Uva calmly points at Mutt again. The next time that thing pisses on my paving, he says coolly, I'll electrify the stone.
Prince hasn't bloody pissed on your disgusting paving, she splutters, and takes two steps forward with her fists raised.
Uva doesn't move. She stops, looks as if she's hyperventilating. Then she seems to summon what highly negligible amount of common sense she has at her disposal.
Come on, Prince, she says with a wave,
then raises her index finger at Uva.
I'm going to tell Anders about this, and then you'll regret it.
Tell your Anders from me that he should stop stretching his groin outside my window.
Crazy old Muppet,
she spits out and heads off towards the parking area.
And his car's crap, you tell him that,
Uva adds for good measure. She makes a gesture at him that he hasn't seen before, although he can guess what it means. Then she and her wretched little dog make off towards Anders's house. Uva turns off by his shed, sees the wet splashes of piss on the paving by the corner of the flower bed. If he weren't busy with more important things this afternoon, he would have gone off to make a doormat of that mutt right away. But he has other things to occupy him. He goes to his tool shed, gets out his hammer action drill and his box of drill bits. When he comes out again, the cat is sitting there, looking at him.
You can clear off now, says Uva.
It doesn't move. Uva shakes his head resignedly.
Hey, I'm not your friend.
The cat stays where it is. Uva throws out his arms.
Christ, you bloody cat, me backing you up when that stupid bag threw stones at you only means I dislike you less than that weedy nutter across the street. And that's not much of an achievement. You should be absolutely clear about that.
The cat seems to give this some careful thought. Uva points at the footpath.
Clear off!
Not at all concerned by this, the cat licks its blood-stained fur. It looks at Uva as if this has been a round of negotiation and it's considering a proposal. Then slowly gets up and pads off, disappearing around the corner of the shed. Uva doesn't even look at it. He goes right into his house and slams the door. Because it's enough now. Now Uva is going to die. Chapter 7. A man called Uva drills a hole for a hook. Uva has put on his best trousers and his going-out shirt. Carefully, he covers the floor with a protective sheet of plastic as if protecting a valuable work of art. Not that the floor is particularly new, although he did sand it less than 2 years ago. He's fairly sure that you don't lose much blood when you hang yourself, and it isn't because of worries about the dust or the drilling, or the marks when he kicks away the stool. In fact, he's glued some plastic pads to the bottom of its legs, so there shouldn't be any marks at all. Nope, the heavy-duty sheets of plastic, which Uva so carefully unfolds, covering the entire hall, living room, and a good part of the kitchen, are not for Uva's own sake at all. He imagines there'll be a hell of a lot of running about in here,
with eager, jumped-up real estate agents trying to get into the house before the ambulance men have so much as got the corpse out. And those bastards are not coming in here, scratching up Uva's floor with their shoes, whether over Uva's dead body or not. They had better be quite clear about that. He puts the stool in the middle of the floor. It's coated in at least 7 different layers of paint. Uva's wife decided on principle that she'd let Uva repaint one of the rooms in their house every 6 months. Or, to be more exact, she decided she wanted a different color in one of the rooms once every 6 months. And when she said as much to Uva, he told her that she might as well forget it. And then she called a decorator for an estimate. And then she told Uva how much she was going to pay the decorator. And then Uva went to fetch his painting stool. You miss the strangest things when you lose someone. Little things. Smiles. The way she turned over in her sleep. Even repainting a room for her. Uva goes to get his box of drill bits. These are single-handedly the most important things when drilling. Not the drill, but the bits. It's like having proper tires on your car instead of messing about with ceramic brakes and nonsense like that. Anyone who knows anything knows that. Uva positions himself in the middle of the room and sizes it up. Then, like a surgeon gazing down on his instruments, his eyes move searchingly over his drill bits. He selects one, slots it into the drill, and tests the trigger a little so that the drill makes a growling sound. Shakes his head, decides that it doesn't feel at all right, and changes the drill bit. He repeats this 4 times before he's satisfied, then walks through the living room, swinging the drill from his hand like a big revolver. He stands in the middle of the floor, staring up at the ceiling. He has to measure this before he gets started, he realizes, so that the hole is centered. The worst thing Uva knows is when someone just drills a hole in the ceiling, hit or miss. He goes to fetch a tape measure. He measures from each of the 4 corners, twice to be on the safe side, and marks the center of the ceiling with a cross. Uva steps down from the stool, walks around to make sure the protective plastic is in position as it should be. Unlocks the door so they won't have to break it down when they come to get him. It's a good door. It'll last many more years. He puts on his suit jacket and checks that the envelope is in his inside pocket. Finally, he turns the photo of his wife in the window so that it looks out towards the shed. He doesn't want to make her watch what he's about to do, but on the other hand, he daren't put the photograph face down either. Uva's wife was always horribly ill-tempered if they ever ended up in some place without a view. She needed something to look at that's alive, she was always saying. So, he points her towards the shed while thinking that maybe that cat annoyance would come by again. Uva's wife liked cat annoyances. He fetches the drill, takes the hook, stands up on the stool, and starts drilling. The first time the doorbell goes, he assumes he's made a mistake and ignores the sound for that very reason. The second time, he realizes that there's actually someone ringing the bell, and he ignores it for that very reason. The third time Uva stops drilling and glares at the door, as if he may be able to convince whoever is standing outside to disappear by his mental powers alone. It doesn't work. The person in question obviously thinks the only rational explanation for his not opening the door the first time around was that he did not hear the doorbell. Uva steps off the stool, strides across the plastic sheets through the living room and into the hall. Does it really have to be so difficult to kill yourself without constantly being disturbed? What? Fumes Uva as he flings the door open. The lanky one only manages by a whisker to pull his big head back and avoid an impact with his face. Hi, the pregnant one exclaims cheerfully beside him, though a foot and a half lower down. Uva looks down at her, then up at him. The lanky one is busy touching every part of his face with some reluctance, as if to check that every protuberance is still where it should be. This is for you, she says in a friendly sort of voice, and then shoves a blue plastic box into Uva's arms. Uva looks skeptical. Cookies, she explains encouragingly. Uva nods slowly as if to confirm this. You've really dressed up, she says with a smile. Uva nods again. And then they stand there, all three of them, waiting for someone to say something. In the end, she looks at the lanky one and shakes her head with resignation.
Oh, please, will you stop fidgeting with your face, darling?
She whispers and gives him a push in the side. The lanky one raises his eyes, meets her gaze, and nods. Looks at Uva. Uva looks at the pregnant one. The lanky one points at the box, and his face lights up. She's Iranian, you know. They bring food with them wherever they go. Uva gives him a blank stare. The lanky one looks even more hesitant. You know, that's why I go so well with Iranians. They like to cook food, and I like to... He begins with an over-the-top smile. Then he goes silent. Uva looks spectacularly uninterested. Eat, the lanky one finishes. He looks as if he's about to make a drum roll in the air with his fingers, but then he looks at the pregnant foreign woman and decides that it would probably be a bad idea. And? Uva offers wearily. She stretches, puts her hands on her stomach.
We just wanted to introduce ourselves now that we're going to be neighbors.
Uva nods tersely and concisely. Okay, bye. He tries to close the door. She stops him with her arm.
And then we wanted to thank you for backing up our trailer. That was very kind of you.
Uva grunts. Reluctantly, he keeps the door open. That's not something to thank me for.
Yeah, it was really nice, she protests.
No, I mean it shouldn't be something to thank me for because a grown man should be able to back up with the trailer, he replies, casting a somewhat unimpressed gaze on the lanky one, who looks at him as if unsure whether or not this is an insult. Uva decides not to help him out of his quandary. He backs away and tries to close the door again.
My name is Parvane,
she says, putting her foot across his threshold. Uva stares at the foot, then at the face it's attached to. As if he's having difficulties understanding what she just did.
I'm Patrick, says the lanky one.
Neither Uva nor Parvana takes the slightest notice of him.
Are you always this unfriendly?
Parvana wonders, with genuine curiosity. Uva looks insulted.
I'm not bloody unfriendly.
You're a bit unfriendly.
No, I'm not.
No, your every word is a cuddle. It really is,
she replies in a way that makes Uva feel she doesn't mean it at all. He releases his grip on the door handle for a moment or two, inspects the box of cookies in his hand.
Right, Arabian cookies. Worth having, are they?
He mutters.
Persian,
she corrects.
What?
Persian, not Arabian. I'm from Iran, you know, where they speak Farsi, she explains.
Farcical? That's the least you could say, Uva agrees.
Her laughter catches him off guard. As if it's carbonated and someone has poured it too fast and it's bubbling over in all directions. It doesn't fit at all with the gray cement and right-angled garden paving stones. It's an untidy, mischievous laugh that refuses to go along with rules and prescriptions. Uva takes a step backwards. His foot sticks to some tape by the threshold. As he tries to shake it off with some irritation, he tears up the corner of the plastic. When he tries to shake off both the tape and the plastic sheeting, he stumbles backwards and pulls up even more of it. Angrily, he regains his balance, remains there on the threshold, trying to summon some calm. Grabs hold of the door handle again, looks at the lanky one, and tries to quickly change the subject.
And what are you, then?
He shrugs his shoulder a little and smiles, slightly overwhelmed.
I'm an IT consultant.
Uva and Parvana shake their heads with such coordination, they could be synchronized swimmers. For a moment, it makes Uva dislike her a little less, although he's very reluctant to admit it to himself. The lanky one seems unaware of all this. Instead, he looks with curiosity at the hammer-action drill, which Uva is holding in a firm grip, like a guerrilla fighter with an AK-47 in his hand. Once the lanky one has finished perusing it, he leans forward and peers into Uva's house.
What are you doing?
Uva looks at him, as one does at a person who has just said, what are you doing, to a man standing with a hammer-action drill in his hand.
I'm
drilling, he replies, scathingly.
Parvana looks at the lanky one and rolls her eyes, and if it hadn't been for her belly, which testified to a willingness on her part to contribute to the survival of the lanky one's genetic makeup, Uva might have found her almost sympathetic at this point.
Oh, says the lanky one with a nod.
Then he leans forward and peers in at the living room floor, neatly covered in the protective sheet of plastic. He lights up and looks at Uva with a grin.
Almost looks like you're about to murder someone.
Uva peruses him in silence. The lanky one clears his throat, a little more reluctant.
I mean, it's like an episode of Dexter,
he says, with a much less confident grin. It's a TV series about a guy who murders people. He trails off and starts poking the toe of his shoe into the gaps between the paving stones outside Uva's front door. Uva shakes his head. It's unclear to whom the lanky one was primarily aiming what he just said.
I have some things to get on with, he says curtly to Parvana and takes a firm grip on the door handle.
Parvana gives the lanky one a purposeful jab in the side with her elbow. The lanky one looks as if he's trying to drum up some courage. He glances at Parvana and looks at Uva with the expression of someone expecting the whole world to start firing rubber bands at him.
Well, the thing is, we actually came because I could do with borrowing a few things.
Uva raises his eyebrows.
What things?
The lanky one clears his throat.
A ladder and an Eileen key.
You mean an Allen key?
Parvana nods. The lanky one looks puzzled.
It's an Eileen key, isn't it?
Allen key, Parvana and Uva correct at the same time.
Parvana nods eagerly at him and points triumphantly at Uva.
He said that's what it's called.
The lanky one mumbles, something inaudible.
And you're just like, whoa, it's an Eileen key,
Parvana jeers. He looks slightly crestfallen.
I never sounded like that.
You did so.
Did not.
Yes, you did.
I didn't.
Uva's gaze travels from one to the other like a large dog watching two mice interfering with its sleep.
You did, says one of them.
That's what you think,
the other one says.
Everyone says it. The majority is not always right.
Shall we Google it or what?
Sure, Google it. Wikipedia it.
Give me your phone.
Use your own.
Duh, I haven't got it with me, dipshit.
Sorry to hear that.
Uva looks at them as their pathetic argument drones on. They remind him of two malfunctioning radiators making high-pitched whines at each other.
Good God, he mutters.
Parvana starts imitating what Uva assumes must be some kind of flying insect. She makes tiny whirring sounds with her lips to irritate her husband. It works quite effectively, both on the lanky one and on Uva. Uva gives up. He goes into the hall, hangs up his suit jacket, puts down the hammer-action drill, puts on his clogs, and walks past them both towards the shed. He's pretty sure neither of them even notices him. He hears them still bickering as he starts backing out with the ladder.
Go on, help him then, Patrick,
Parvana bursts out when she catches sight of him. The lanky one takes a few steps toward him with fumbling movements. Uva keeps his eyes on him as if watching a blind man at the wheel of a crowded city bus. And only after that does Uva realize that, in his absence, his property has been invaded by yet another person. Rune's wife, Anita, from farther down the street, is standing next to Parvana, blithely watching the spectacle. Uva decides the only rational response must be to pretend that she's doing no such thing. He feels anything else would only encourage her. He hands the lanky one a cylindrical case with a set of neatly sorted Allen keys.
Oh, look how many there are,
says the imbecile thoughtfully, gazing into the case.
What size are you after? Asks Uva.
The lanky one looks at him as people do when they lack the self-possession to say what they are thinking.
The usual size?
Uva looks at him for a long, long time.
What are you using these things for? He says at last.
To fix an IKEA wardrobe we took apart when we moved, and then I forgot where I put the Eileen key,
he explains, apparently without a trace of shame.
Uva looks at the ladder.
And this wardrobe's on the roof, is it?
The lanky one sniggers and shakes his head.
Oh, right. See what you mean? No, I need the ladder because the upstairs window is jammed. Won't open.
He adds the last part as if Uva would not otherwise be able to understand the implications of that word, jammed.
So, now you're going to try to open it from the outside?
Uva wonders. The lanky one nods and clumsily takes the ladder from him. Uva looks as if he's about to say something else, but he seems to change his mind. He turns to Parvana.
And why exactly are you here?
Moral support, she twitters.
Uva doesn't look entirely convinced, nor does the lanky one. Uva's gaze wanders reluctantly back to Rune's wife. She's still there. It seems like years since he last saw her, or at least since he really looked at her. She's gone ancient. People all seem to get ancient behind Uva's back these days.
Yes, says Uva.
Rune's wife smiles mildly and clasps her hands across her hips.
Uva, you know I don't want to disturb you, but it's about the radiators in our house. We can't get any heat into them,
she says carefully and smiles and turns at Uva, the lanky one, and Parvana. Parvana and the lanky one smile back. Uva looks at his dented wristwatch.
Does no one on this street have a job to go to anymore? He wonders.
I'm retired,
says Rune's wife, almost apologetically.
I'm on maternity leave,
says Parvana, patting her stomach proudly.
I'm an IT consultant, says the lanky one, also proudly.
Uva and Parvana again indulge in a bit of synchronized head shaking. Rune's wife makes another attempt.
I think it could be the radiators.
Have you bled them? Says Uva.
She shakes her head and looks curious.
You think it could be because of that?
Uva rolls his eyes.
Uva!
Parvana roars at him at once, as if she's a reprimanding schoolmistress. Uva glares at her. She glares back.
Stop being rude, she orders.
I told you I'm not rude.
Her eyes are unwavering. He makes a little grunt, then goes back to standing in the doorway.
He thinks it could sort of be enough now. All he wants is to die. Why can't these lunatics respect that?
Parvana puts her hand, encouragingly, on Rune's wife's arm.
I'm sure Uva can help you with the radiators. That would be amazingly kind of you, Uva,
Rune's wife says at once, brightening. Uva sticks his hands in his pockets, kicks at the loose plastic by the threshold.
Can't your man sort out that kind of thing in his own house?
Rune's wife shakes her head mournfully.
No, Rune has been really ill lately, you see. They say it's Alzheimer's. He's in a wheelchair as well. It's been a bit uphill.
Uva nods with faint recognition, as if he has been reminded of something his wife told him 1,000 times, although he still managed to forget it all the time.
Yeah, yeah, he says impatiently.
You can go and breathe their radiators, can't you, Uva?
Says Parvana. Uva glances at her as if considering a firm retort, but instead, he just looks down at the ground.
Or is that too much to ask?
She continues, drilling him with her gaze and crossing her arms firmly across her stomach. Uva shakes his head.
You don't breathe radiators, you bleed them. Jesus.
He looks up and gives them the once-over.
Have you never bled a radiator before, or what?
No,
says Parvana, unmoved. Rune's wife looks at the lanky one a little anxiously.
I haven't got a clue what they're talking about, he says calmly to her.
Rune's wife nods resignedly, looks at Uva again.
It would be really nice of you, Uva, if it isn't too much of a bother.
Uva just stands there, staring down at the threshold.
Maybe this could have been thought about before you organized a coup d'etat in the Residents Association,
he says quietly, his words punctuated by a series of discreet coughs.
Before she what?
Says Parvana. Rune's wife clears her throat.
But, dear Uva, there was never a coup d'etat.
It was so, says Uva grumpily.
Rune's wife looks at Parvana with an embarrassed little smile. Well, you see, Rune and Uva...